our third argument today and third and the last scheduled argument for September. And so I'll now call 11 AP 825, 11 AP 826, Dane County Department of Human Services versus Mabel K. Arguing on behalf of Mabel K will be Attorney Brian Finley. You will have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Finley. And arguing on behalf of the Dane County Department of Human Services is Gary Rayfield, Assistant Corporation Counsel. You have 30 minutes. Mr. Finley, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Before I get into the meat of my argument, I want to point out two things in the record that I didn't bring forward accurately before or fully. And the first is that I told the court that Mabel had an IQ of 60. Well, when I go back and look through the court report, the psychological evaluation of Dr. Black said that she had a performance IQ of 60, but a full IQ of 54. And I think that's important when determining whether her action was egregious, because it's extremely low. The second thing I want to bring to the court's attention is that this case was fully briefed in the Court of Appeals on November 16, 2011, which means that if the Court of Appeals had just decided the case, this would have been over before Christmas. And I think that there are several times in this case when there were delays caused by the errors of the courts.
How could they have decided the case and concluded it?
How they could have decided it? Well, they certainly could have decided the remedy. They certainly could have decided whether there was whether the default was proper and the denial of the motion to vacate the default was proper. So I think they could, and so I think that's what they could have decided. That gets me to my first point, which is that clearly they had statutory authority. They had jurisdiction. 809-107-6-AM says that for when fact-finding is required, they are to retain jurisdiction and remand to the trial court. The fact that they retain jurisdiction means that the appeal has to be from the original order terminating the parental rights. I don't know any other way to read the statute. And what's more, I've not heard any other way from the other side on how to read it.
Why is that important?
Why is that important? Mm-hmm. Because every word of the statute has to be given import. That's a standard, it's a basic rule of statutory construction. You can't just read it out because it's inconvenient or doesn't fit. It has to have meant something. And I think when I went back and looked at the legislative history of this, it's very clear. The comment to the rule that enacted this said it was for the purposes of additional fact-finding. And I think in that respect, it is very analogous to 80930, which allows additional fact-finding for post-conviction motions and so on. In fact, the comment talks about additional fact-finding when you're alleging ineffective assistance of counsel cases. So I think the only possible way to read it is that the court retained jurisdiction. If they had decided this and opposing counsel had said, well, that was totally wrong, you know, accept my petition, I don't think there's any chance you would have done that because clearly the statute grants jurisdiction. They retain jurisdiction.
Counsel, I'll have to reread the orders again, but as I read the order of dismissal, there's one in December 21st and then the subsequent, that was the one that they kind of did on their own research. The court did on its own research and then after asking for contemporaneous briefs, issued another decision on January 11th. As I read it, it was just a motion dismissing the appeal, but not necessarily for lack of jurisdiction. So I'm not quite getting
Your point. They have jurisdiction.
Well, then why didn't they decide the issues that were on appeal if they had jurisdiction? What's the authority to punt, basically,
which is
what they did?
The question that I understood in part was I don't know the answer, but I understood in part that they didn't know what rules of procedure applied. Was it an appeal as of right? Is it a permissive appeal? And so, although your point is well taken, I guess I just took it as them deciding not to grant the appeal. They dismissed it. Hmm? You said you think they dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction? But where do you point to tell me that?
Well, I'd have to look at their order, but they clearly said that in their order they did not believe that it was a final order.
That's right.
And therefore, they didn't have the authority to consider the matter.
Oh, but they have discretion on non-final orders.
Well, again, they could have decided this once it was fully briefed, whether or not...
They could have, but they didn't have to. If they were going to get rid of it as a non-final order, they don't have to take that case. They looked at this and they said it's not final because it went back to the trial court under the provisions, and therefore trial court's got it again. That's what the trial court said. I've got it, and I'm going to handle it in this way, right?
Part of the problem with that is that by doing this, it basically shifted the burden of persuasion. It did not give Mabel Kay an entirely new hearing in front of a different judge. And I think given the fact that the trial court has twice made findings that, well, Mabel Kay has failed to prove that she would have been able to meet the CHIPS conditions, she's already prejudged this. And I think that it's fundamentally unfair to not grant her a new trial. And I don't know of any other procedure where you're not entitled to an entirely new fact-finding once there's been a denial of the right to counsel.
Mr. Finley, as I understand what you're asking for in terms of remedy, is that you not only want this to go back for a new judge, don't you want a jury trial as well?
That's correct.
And why do you think you're entitled to that?
Because that is the standard, entirely new remedy. The error occurred at fact-finding. So she's entitled to a new fact-finding hearing. And I don't know of any other situation when you're entitled to a new fact-finding hearing where you don't just start over. I understand it's a little complicated because what you have is the intersection of default and denial of the right to counsel. That, I believe, is where the complication occurs here. But why complicate this? This shouldn't happen very often. The simple rule is you deny counsel, you get an entirely new fact-finding.
Counsel, here I understand that, well, obviously there was a jury trial and there was a demand for a jury trial that was submitted by the petitioner. Does that demand for a jury for a fact-finding, this is a follow-up of Justice Crooks's question, does that demand for a jury trial, and you have a right to a jury trial in TPRs, right, to request them. So does that demand for a jury trial and the statutory right to a jury trial continue on remand? And if so, explain that to me.
Well, I believe it does continue on remand. I forget which case it was, Tequila S. Or Shirley E., but, I mean, this court was very clear to say that there has to be a waiver of that right, and simply not showing up is not the same as a waiver. You may have forfeited if you're in default or so on, but it's not a waiver. And so the fact that there's been a remand of the fact-finding, I believe that the right to trial should continue.
Right, to jury trial should continue.
That's right.
Well, when a party or the party's lawyer misbehaves in one fashion or other, the court can impose sanctions.
That's correct.
And it seems to me it's arguable, I didn't check if there are any cases, it's arguable that when somebody asks for a jury trial, the jury is impaneled, the jury is sitting, and then the person does not show up, and the court is going to declare a default or in some fashion going to sanction the litigant who is told they've got to be there, that the, why isn't a plausible sanction? Look, I just can't keep this jury for 2 more hours just sitting around waiting for you to show up. So no more jury. That's the sanction. I'll open it up. I'll take the evidence. I'll do it the way I should have done it, but no jury. What's the matter with that?
Well, courts can. As the concurrence pointed out in Shirley E., this is not a standard civil appeal. So you've got the situation where you find the one of the parties in default, but you still have to make a fact-finding, go through the fact-finding hearing. So it's possible that you can sanction the party by saying you've lost your right to trial. I'm not disputing that. But in the case you're talking about, one of the cases my opponent cited to was Garfoot versus Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, and that was a case in which they were saying, should the intransigence of the attorneys be imputed to the client? And the answer is not necessarily.
That's right.
And furthermore, he cited that case for the idea that conduct is egregious and without where there's no excusable, justifiable excuse. But it went on to say that, look, egregious conduct requires more. It requires an attempt to affect the outcome of the proceeding or, quote, a flagrant knowing disregard of the judicial process. And I think under the facts of this case, given the fact that my client has an IQ of 54, it's not possible to say that she was engaged in flagrant knowing disregard of the judicial process. That's especially true since she was never warned of the consequences of default. And the record is very clear that that occurred only after she didn't show up in court. So you have a extremely slow, mentally retarded person who was not warned. It's simply not fair under the facts of this case to find that default applies. There are other reasons for finding why the Court of Appeals order, excuse me, that the remand order is a final order for purposes of appeal. The civil rule applies only when the order grants an entirely new trial. That did not happen here. The court granted partial relief and denied partial relief. And getting back to your question of, couldn't the Court of Appeals just say, okay? Well, they could have, but they didn't actually enter an opinion on that was the proper remedy. In my opinion, they ducked the issue. They didn't want to address it. I also think it's a final order in that it decided all of the issues with respect to Mabel K. I mean, it granted partial relief and denied partial relief. It didn't grant relief on the default issues at all. It denied those completely. And it said it fashioned a remedy, but I think it's the wrong remedy. I think my opponent agrees that the court had discretion to hear this. And I'm baffled why, if that's the case, the court did not decide it. Now, we've argued about whether it's faster or slower to have the courts hear this. I think the rule should be that the court retains jurisdiction, that's what the statute says, and the court in its own judgment compassion the appropriate remedy. But to say, well, we can't decide this because it's not a final order, I don't think that's what the statute thought of, and I don't think that's what the proper remedy should be. I mean,
what remedy would you have this court apply?
Well, the remedy I would have is that a remand order is merely supplemental to a final order, which remains within the Court of Appeals jurisdiction, so that any remand order is just supplemental. That's the way it is in a 80930 appeal. I mean, you can still...
Just so I'm clear, you're saying a remand order by the Court of Appeals for further fact-finding at the circuit court is a final order.
No, I'm sorry. The order on remand of the trial court is merely supplemental to the original order denying or granting termination order. And so it's just supplemental, and it's within the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals to decide it and to decide how they want to deal with that.
But is it your position, this gets kind of tricky, but is it your position that the Court of Appeals had to take the appeal, that is, that there is an appeal as of right, because it's akin to 80930, or they had the discretion to?
I believe that both are true, that they had to take it in this case because the order on remand was merely supplemental. It was merely additional fact-finding. But they also could have done it discretionary.
The order on remand was merely supplemental, you say merely fact-finding. As I recall, it was in part to address the ineffective assistance of counsel issue that had been presented.
That's correct. And those issues could have easily been addressed by the Court of Appeals, whether that was correctly decided or not. I mean, the whole order could have been decided.
Mm-hmm.
What the Court of Appeals didn't do by sending it back is it didn't answer the question of what is the remedy.
Yes. Okay, let's get to the remedy then.
Okay.
One of the things you address is the order that the circuit court had was send it back. I'm going to pick up where I left off. What's wrong with that?
Because it switches the burden of proof. I mean, you had a partial truncated hearing in which the county got to present its evidence or some of its evidence, and the court has decided, yep, that's enough to establish grounds that she's unfit. And then subsequent to that, she has said twice, although not entirely clearly, that, I believe that our petitioner is unable to prove that there are any defenses to the CHIPS claim.
How does the right of if it's being sent back for a, let me use the phrase, new trial, at least some people, some of the writings characterize it as akin to that and therefore civil in nature and non-final. How does that intersect with the request for substitution when a case is sent back?
The statutes say that if the Court of Appeals reverses or modifies a trial court's order, that following remand back to the trial court, they're entitled to substitution of a new judge. Well, in this case, it was the trial court itself which modified the order. So it's not entirely clear that Mabel Kay is entitled to substitution of judge. And I think given the facts of this case, where we have some prejudgment occurring, that's fundamentally unfair.
And how does it intersect with the statutory right, let's see, for a fact-finding hearing under 48.31, that the hearing shall be to the court unless the parent demands a jury trial, and then it goes on in a jury trial. How does it intersect with the statutory right
to jury trial.
Well, in this case, the parent did request a jury trial. So the only way...
For a fact-finding hearing.
So the only way she could lose it would be if the trial court's finding that she was properly defaulted means that on remand she's lost that right. And I don't believe that the trial court's ruling on default was correct. And I also don't think that it's appropriate under the facts of this case to find that she's lost her right to substitution.
One of the things that there are a lot of loose ends as I see this. Now, maybe everyone else has it tied up neatly and tight. One of the issues that was advanced below, as I recall, was should a default have been entered? In other words, you can appear by counsel. That's clear that you have the right to appear by counsel. And there was a question about whether or not a default could be properly entered because a counsel was there and ready to put on testimony on her behalf. But that issue that I saw in the underlying in the lower courts isn't here, as I understand it.
That's correct. The testimony on the remand hearing was from the defense attorneys was that the county routinely asks for orders to appear in Dane County. And the testimony was that the courts always, that was the word, grants those orders. And what that does, I think that's wrong, personally. And we argued about that in the Court of Appeals. And in fact, much of their, if you'll look, much of their brief was dedicated to defending that proposition. I think it's wrong because it sets these parents up for failure. And it creates different rules for them than for any other set of civil litigants. And had an order like that not been entered in this case, then no default would be appropriate. Remember, in Shirley E., it was the second time the parent didn't show up that the default order was entered. Now, I was not wise to drop this, but I thought that was not my best issue, given the fact that the judge ruled clearly that she would have ordered it in this case for specific reasons. So that's why I did not bring that forward to this court. But I think it's wrong. I think it occurs all the time. And I would love to argue it in a different case. I don't know if that – you don't seem satisfied with that answer.
That's just fine.
Okay. One of the things that I want to get to in this is the fact that, as I said at the very top, the delays in this case were totally unnecessary. When we can argue about whether Shirley's Mabel's behavior was egregious, which is extreme, substantial, and persistent. I don't think it was. She's got an IQ of 54. But when she showed up in court, there was absolutely no reason why the court should have denied her her day in court. If the court had simply said, okay, you can participate, this would have been over a year and a half ago. She'd have had her day in court, and it would have been decided on the equities.
Is I asking us then to hold as a matter of law that it was an erroneous exercise of discretion to grant default judgment on that day when she appeared?
That's correct.
Later?
I believe it was erroneous exercise of discretion, and especially not to vacate it when she walked into court 10 minutes after the court entered its default order. The court entered a default order at 10:35. Mabel Kay walked in the court 10 minutes later. There was no reason, given the fact that this court favors giving litigants their day in court, there was no reason not to allow her to attend.
What did the circuit court do? Say, oh, there is a default judgment, but I've got to take evidence anyway? So I'll now take the evidence, and you, attorney, can't introduce any evidence. You can just cross-examine. Is that what the trial court said?
Yeah, she said you could just cross-examine, but she said only to the, you couldn't cross-examine on anything not introduced by the county.
Was the default judgment ever vacated?
No, it was not.
Then does the judge, after she hears the evidence presented by the county, what does she do? Reaffirm the default judgment, which then will hold for the county?
That's correct.
And default judgment had to say, county wins. She's held unfit.
That's correct. Right? And at one point, she actually asked counsel and Mabel to leave the table because she had been excluded. She did say that counsel could remain and observe, but she said, no, you can't participate here anymore at all.
So all she's doing is firming up her default judgment.
Well, that's what she did after she entered it, yes.
First she entered it, then she took the evidence, and then she said, I was right all the time.
That's correct. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Corporation Counsel, representing the Dane County Department.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Rehfeld from the Dane County Corporation Counsel's office. With me today, not arguing, is the guardian ad litem, Ginger Murray. Ginger has been guardian ad litem for both of these kids, as well as the other third child that's been referenced here. I guess what I'd like to do is, rather than repeat what I've argued in writing, is go to some of the factual things that I think are really important here. I have a little bit of an advantage over Attorney Finley here in that I was trial counsel in the first case, the Sam C. case, which was one of Mabel's other children. I was also trial counsel and participated completely in the hearing that's subject to this appeal. Attorney Finley has been only appellate counsel for Mabel K. He was not physically present. He was not there. And again, I have a little advantage because of that. I want to clarify just a few things that went on. First of all, when Mabel K. was found in default, that was the second day of a scheduled three-day trial. And one of the important things to remember is if you look at the transcript, and that is, and when I refer to the record, I'm always going to refer to Isaiah's record case, because the case for May K. is a little bit of different ordering. And the reason being is I brought a motion for partial summary judgment in May K.'s case, which was granted, so the documents don't all track.
Excuse me, Counselor. Could I bother you to lift up your podium? There's a sure button there under there that makes it taller, and you're fairly tall. It's hard for me to hear you.
We're going to have a tape measure for all lawyers now, and then calibrate it to the podium.
You're not offended by being called fairly tall, are you?
No, I'm not. You got it. That's a family curse.
Okay, that helps me a lot. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, and I know if it's the microphone wasn't picking things up. I want to go back to where I was again. One of the comments made is that Mabel K. was never warned of default. That's not true.
Say that one more time, please.
Okay, one of the comments that's been made is that Mabel K. was never warned of default. Okay, that's not true. If you look at document either number one or number two, which is in the summons of both of these cases, which she was personally served, there is a warning of default right in that summons. That is a state form that warns everybody of default. The second thing is she had personal experience with default because in the previous case, with regard to Sam C., she was defaulted for being 3 hours late.
Counsel, do you agree that the circuit court entered a default judgment contrary to the directives under Evelyn and Shirley as to how it should be done?
If you could be just a little more specific,
okay.
Your Honor, in the
sure.
question.
In paragraph 50 of the Shirley E. case, as
here.
It is discussing Evelyn C.R., so I'm going to hit both of them. It says, because the circuit court should not have found Shirley E. in default before hearing evidence of the fact-finding phase, Shirley E.'s attorney should not have been barred from participating. Thus, the circuit court violated Shirley E.'s hero's statutory right to counsel in the fact-finding phase. Here, the circuit court itself confessed error and as to the manner in which it conducted the default judgment because it said it was contrary to the directive of Shirley E. and Evelyn C.R. Do you disagree with the circuit court's assessment that the directives of Evelyn C.R. and Shirley E.?
I think what the circuit court should have done, Your Honor, is give the opportunity to Mabel's counsel to present any evidence she had. But remember two important things at that point in time. One, Mabel wasn't there, so she wasn't as a witness. And if you look at the transcript from the Mockner hearing, the counsel had no other people subpoenaed to be there on that day, so there was no opportunity for her to present anything. Even though there is a mention in the transcript, and again, it's record document number 91. I've got it sitting right in front of me here. What happened was is when Mabel called in and said, I'm not going to be there, the court implored her counsel to get a hold of her and have her come in. And counsel mentions that Mabel Kay was only showed up 10 minutes after the default was granted. The reason that was is because we had to take evidence we did. And the witness is Michael Bain.
Let me just return to my question. And my question is, do you disagree with the circuit court that it committed error in the way that it in the procedure and manner in which it granted a default judgment here?
If you limit that to the fact that she did not offer counsel the opportunity to present evidence on behalf of Mabel Kay, I would agree that she erred, yes.
Okay, so we have error here. I think we do. Okay. Now the question is the remedy for the error.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what this case, I think, in large part is about and what procedure should be followed. Tell me why where and why the record would indicate that having asked for a jury trial under the statute, that there is a justification for forfeiture of a jury trial, or that the record shows there was a forfeiture of the jury trial, or anything that would help me find in the record where this analysis took place of the forfeiture of the right to an invoked jury trial.
I think it goes along with the default, Your Honor, and I think it's the procedure outlined in the Shirley E. case. It talks in the Shirley E. case about the court conducting a fact-finding hearing sufficient to support the petition for termination of parental rights.
Okay, so if you're going to in order to do the first stage, right, the county, anyone, the petitioner for termination has to put up the case. They have to prove the case. The judge can't say default, the end, you win, county.
Right? And Your Honor, I think what that is, if I read this court's precedents properly, I think that's consistent with the heightened protections for parents in TPR cases, and it's consistent with the constitutional basis on which a lot of the rights of parents are based. That unlike the traditional civil default, and I know, for example, Justice Ziegler, Justice Bradley, Justice Crooks, and Justice Gableman were all trial court judges. And you know what a common default looks like. And default in a TPR is a little different because this court has commanded that the court must have sufficient evidence. Now, remember that we went through a full day of trial. That first day of jury trial was Monday. And I'll tell you, Your Honor, you know, whenever you do a case and things happen wrong, that it rarely is the case you think it's going to be when you start out. Things change, they mutate. You're going, oh, my God, how did we get here? I'll tell you one thing that I have thought over probably 50 times since I did this. The testimony that I had provided when the default was imminent was from Mike Bateman. Mike is a social service specialist with the department, and he supervised visits. That information was solely to support one of the two claims here. That was for under 48415 sub 1 abandonment. I had already fully proved the claim under 48415 sub 2 for continuing need of protection and service by testimony on Monday. I was trying to be safe. I was trying to protect these kids and make sure we get to permanency, because if something that I did wrong in the first part of the case cropped up, I would have the fallback position of being able to argue abandonment in addition to continuing need as a basis for TPR. Now, again, I just want to get back to the timing of this because I think it's a little bit important here. Okay, and it goes to whether the court could have found Mabel to be egregious, her conduct, and the 806.07 motion a little bit. Attorney Finley keeps saying she showed up 10 minutes after the default was granted. That is absolutely accurate. but is not the complete story. She was scheduled to be in court at 9 o'clock that morning, and she did not show up until almost 10:45. When she failed to appear originally, I moved for default right away based upon the order for appearance, which was properly granted. Okay, Mabel knew of the consequences of default because of the summons. She knew because it happened to her in a prior case she had been defaulted. She had personal experience with it. All right, so if you read the transcript, and again, it's in document number 91. I think that's really important. I think I attached a lot of it to my appendix. So if you have my brief right there, you can go right to the back in my appendix. That she told counsel she would be there, and counsel conveyed it to the court about 8:45. 8:45, she does not show up. Okay? It becomes 8:45, she does not.
The court was continuing the jury trial.
We were continuing the jury trial with regard to the father, Lee.
That's right. I mean, on the first day of trial, in fact, a large part of the transcript involves testimony regarding him, if I recall correctly. I mean, the cases were consolidated at the time. They're both being tried. So even though she wasn't there, it was continuing on.
Right. We were continuing on with the dad's part of the case. I had moved for default. The trial judge said we're holding the default in advance. I'm giving her counsel opportunity to produce her and have her show up. She said she'd be there at 9:45.
And the jury was then listening, before 9:45, listening to the testimony that you were still on.
With regard to the father, yes, that's correct.
With regard to the father. Now, you mentioned the Shirley E. case, but that wasn't a jury trial case. There was no, that I can see in the record, any invocation. That was just a matter of a hearing in an order for personal appearance. So what I'm concerned about is I don't find on this issue of someone who has a statutory right to a jury trial. An attorney will be appointed for you at public expense in a TPR case. And it says for a fact-finding hearing, you have the right to have a jury trial.
Right.
That's what's concerning me, that right. And I don't see in the record any waiver of that right. I don't see any record of the forfeiture of that right. And, in fact, the language, as I recall, in Shirley E. says, you know, that you'll have a fact-finding hearing. Well, there's been a request for a fact-finding hearing before a jury. So, and it hasn't been waived and it hasn't been forfeited. In terms of any language in the record, so what do you do?
Okay, I think if I interpret your question, it's either has to be waived or forfeited, and my argument would be that it's forfeited by virtue of failing to comply with the court's scheduling order for personal appearance. I think if you read the Shirley E. case, I think it's kind of implicit in that, and I think that's the forfeiture. Otherwise, what's the penalty for violating the court's order for personal appearance? If you don't lose at least the right to the jury trial.
Did Shirley E. lose the right to counsel? That's another statutory right. That's
Your Honor, I never insist, and let me be really clear on this. There is a huge difference between the deprivation of counsel in Shirley E. and in our instant case. In Shirley E., the trial court told counsel to basically leave at fact-finding and leave at disposition. This is a very small, limited deprivation of counsel. She participated in the entire first day of trial. She could have participated had she been there. She participated in disposition with counsel. So to me, there's a night and day difference between the Shirley E. facts and the facts of the instant case.
But both are deprivation of counsel that require, and with the statutory right, the language of Shirley E. says you have the right, and if you know, there's been no...
In the criminal cases on counsel, and it's another right, and it's the right to put up your defense.
Correct.
And when you tie counsel's hand behind his or her back by saying cross-examine only, can't put on any of your own evidence, you're interfering with effective counsel. I mean, when you say you have a right to counsel, it means really effective counsel.
Absolutely, it does, Your Honor, yes.
You're interfering with effective counsel, and you're interfering with your right to put on a defense.
I understand. And, Your Honor, I don't disagree that a court could reasonably view that as deprivation of counsel. But, again, I want to contrast that with the Shirley E. situation where it was absolutely incomplete. And if you read all the cases, starting Gideon versus Wainwright, in the two cases that I cited, I'm going to mess the first one. I think it's Gordon and Harvey. It's in my argument. Is there is almost no case where it wasn't a complete deprivation of counsel in which it was returned for a new trial. If you look at the entire movement, and again, you know from my argument that I think the court should make a distinction between a statutory right to counsel and a constitutional right to counsel. We're clearly here in TPR where this right to counsel is statutory, not constitutional. All right. The entire movement.
Well,
in the criminal
that it's statutory doesn't mean that it's not constitutional.
Your Honor, this court hasn't decided that yet, and
that's
I would agree.
Right.
And
that's right. I'm. That's what my correction is. So that
Yep. You
might have had the legislature figuring, hey, this might be constitutional. We're going to just set it out and
if this
do
court
that.
Today clarifies that the statutory right to counsel in TPRs is coterminous with a constitutional right to counsel, that's fine, and that will really help a lot of practitioners in the field. We very much appreciate that guidance. But if you read the MDS case, which is the case where this court, Judge Callow, I think, wrote it, decides that there is the right to counsel, it is simply based on a statutory basis. And I know the right to counsel has got some underpinnings and statutory things because there was a point in time in which under 4823, I think, at that time, Governor Thompson tried to remove the counsel right to counsel in Chip's cases and said a court could never appoint. And the Court of Appeals declared that statute invalid, and under Joni B. said the court's going to have to be able to have the discretion to appoint counsel at some point in time, but we're going to use the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. And we're going to look at the private right, we're going to look at the public right, and we're going to look at the risk of erroneous deprivation. Okay? Mm-hmm. And balanced it and said there's going to be still kinds the judge can appoint in the Chips. Mm-hmm. Now, if in MDS, the court wanted to say constitutional right, why didn't it just say that? The whole analysis, in fact, what had happened is the court's underlying opinions, PLS, which I think was a paternity case, and SSK, which was a CHIPS case, decided on constitutional right to counsel, and the MDS court overruled that, saying it wasn't constitutional. So that's the guidance that the practitioners have now. If there's further guidance, we'd much greatly appreciate it.
Does the jury sit in the disposition phase?
Your Honor, they do not. If the best parallel I can draw, I was talking to my brother last night, and he wanted to know about this, and I think he's probably listening right now. He asked me about that, and what I explained to him is it's much like a criminal case. The guilt phase is like the fact phase. There's your jury trial. The sentencing phase is like the disposition. Sentencing is done by a court. Disposition is done by the court.
In the Evelyn C.R. case, some evidence that should have been presented to a jury wasn't, is that right?
Your Honor, I didn't grab that case and bring it up here with me, but if I could just find that for a second, I know I got it here somewhere.
Yes. Well, if memory serves me...
Sorry, Your Honor, I can't pull my hands on it right now, but if you could just...
If memory serves me correctly, there was a fact-finding hearing. There was a jury at that hearing. I believe it was Judge Sumi. And this court indicated that the fact-finding hearing in front of the jury was imperfect, but that evidence brought in at the disposition stage corrected the problem. And that evidence came in without the jury. Okay. Does that have any bearing on the issues here?
I think it does, Your Honor. And I think, again, I'm going in my memory of the case without having it in front of me. And I think what happened in the Evelyn CR case is this court determined that because the evidence eventually got there, because the evidence eventually got there, the fact that Judge Sumi failed to take evidence supporting the default before the default, but heard it later at the disposition was harmless error. I think that's what this court ruled in that case. And I would say that does make a difference here. And, Your Honor, I want to go to, before we, you know, leave that, if you got another follow-up, please ask me right away because I've got a thought and I don't really want to lose it.
Well, what I would like to ask you is to, if you just prevail here today,
right.
What happens next okay. in the trial court?
Your Honor, let's assume you do exactly what the Court of Appeals did and they dismiss, okay? It's going to go back to the trial court. The trial court's going to take evidence, allow the mother to present her evidence. It says it's going to return her to the position where the error occurred, okay? The trial court will make a determination whether grounds exist and whether there's a finding of unfitness. If grounds exist and a finding of unfitness is made, it'll go to a dispositional hearing. And again, like you observed, the dispositional hearing is just to the court. The court will make an order on disposition. If the order is on disposition, is terminating parental rights, Mabel K. will have the right to appeal that final order.
Isn't it somewhat irregular, however, to have part of the fact-finding hearing before a jury and the other part not before a jury, and to have part of it with Counsel A, and Counsel A isn't in the picture anymore, so that the rest would have to be with Counsel B? I mean, basically, I think your opposing counsel is arguing there are so many errors and so much irregularity here that we should start from scratch.
I think he's arguing that, Your Honor, but I think the sole error here is the limited deprivation of counsel here. This case pales in comparison to what happened in Shirley E. In Shirley E., the Milwaukee Circuit Court told counsel to take a hike. Take a hike at fact-finding and take a hike at disposition. Okay? And, again, if you look at the cases that I've cited regarding deprivation of counsel, and they're almost all criminal cases because that's where the jurisprudence is coming from. This limited deprivation of counsel has never before supported a remand for a completely new trial. I don't see a single case. Counsel didn't cite a case. I haven't been able to locate a case. That's what I was looking for to try to, you know, get up here. And if I'd have found a case, of course, I would have argued against it. But if I would have found a case where limited deprivations are treated differently, there's a case that I'm aware of called State versus Anderson that's not in my brief, 291 Wiss 2nd, 673, where it talks about Shirley. It doesn't talk about Shirley. I'm sorry. It says that the Supreme Court here, that's you people, explained that a harmless error analysis may apply to certain violations of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, even when such a violation occurs at a critical stage. And that's Anderson 291 with second at paragraph 76. So again, if even if I concede the argument that it's the same level of scrutiny as a constitutional right, look to constitutional cases to see how they handle it. And that would be my offer to the court as a guide to how to deal with this.
I'm not sure that the phrase you use of limited violation of right to counsel is appropriate. Certainly, it's in contrast with a case where the judge said, out of here. But here the judge said, in response to the attorney for the mother, you can cross-examine this witness only, and I'm going to circumscribe your cross-examination. The attorney for the mother says, but judge, we have, I forget what, that may be ample evidence to defeat the abandonment claim, and then she referenced and sufficient evidence to rebut. So in other words, her continuing Chip's evidence wasn't as strong, but a couple of times in the record, she proffered to the judge that, hey, we have enough here to beat the abandonment one. And the judge said, I'm not going to allow you to put on any testimony. Now, that might be limited vis-a-vis a judge kicking an attorney out of the courtroom totally. But when an attorney says, I have evidence sufficient to make the county lose here, and the court denies the ability of that attorney to put on any of the evidence. I mean, after all, it wasn't time in the court hearing for her to put that evidence on right then. You guys were still dealing with the dad's case, I mean, as I understand and look at the transcripts that morning. So, you know.
Your Honor, at that point in time, we were actually dealing with the mom's case because the jury was excused for a while when the mom showed up and we were dealing with all those issues. That's what happened. I don't know what phrase you want to use, Your Honor. If you could give me the phrase, I will use that. I mean, if you feel more comfortable. But to me, it's less than the complete denial in Gideon versus Wainwright. It's less than the complete denial in Shirley E. Okay? There was a full day of trial in which counsel fully participated, cross-examined witnesses, did all that. The case that I cited to you that was unpublished is contained in my appendix. It's Henry, the termination of Charles P. Jr. And if you look at the Mockner hearing testimony of Attorney Lehner, who represented Mabel K. at the trial court, what Attorney Lehner told you is, I didn't have any witnesses subpoenaed for that day, and my client wasn't there when the default was entered. Okay, she had nobody to present to the court. Okay, she could have requested a continuance, but the continuance could have been denied within the discretion of the court. The Charles P. case provides at least a reasoned examination of what happens in that fact scenario. And you have to remember one thing, Your Honor, and I think this is absolutely critical, and I know you're really interested in the rights of what's going on with this litigant. The reason we're in this mix is because that mother didn't show up when she was ordered to be there by the court. It wasn't the cases like in Garfoot where the counsel misbehaved, and the question is, do we tag the party with this? It's the actual party who has misbehaved here. She's not only violated an order of the court by not showing up in person, she told the court she'd be in at 9:45. She appeared almost an hour after that. When the court entered the default, had no idea whether she was going to appear or not, and then if you read the transcript, it said, oh, by the way, I got breakfast on the way in. Your Honor, if I would have showed up at 1:45 or 2 o'clock, and you asked Mr. Rayfeld, where the heck were you? I was over at Francesca's having lunch. I hope you'd be angry. And I'd hope you'd want to have some sort of sanction in your toolkit, like they talk about in the Shirley E. case. When I look at the recitation under 804.12.2a about the kind of sanctions that a court can impose. It was, I think, Justice Prosser's concurrence to Shirley E. that says, what do we leave the trial court with if we can't do something with recalcitrant parents? And that's the question I'd ask the court, too.
I suspect that your IQ is quite a bit higher than...
And Your Honor, if you want to go to that, too, I want you guys to look very carefully at the record. What Attorney Finley asserts about her IQ is not entirely accurate. The only evidence of her IQ in the record is contained in the disposition report of Joyce Brown, and I can give you the record cite on that. I would also invite you in the default hearing. I introduced two transcripts of deposition taken from Mabel K. One was in the prior case for Sam C., and one was in the current case here. And if you read those transcripts, they're trial exhibits 9 and 10, and you read her testimony on document record 91, okay, you will see that you have somebody that's extremely responsive to questions. You will see you have someone that when Attorney Murray questioned her in the deposition, she rattled off about 5 or 6 consistent addresses, including apartment number and zip code for each one of her cases. Read those transcripts. Read those exhibits. Again, you have a full deposition transcript that was introduced by me. And the most important thing you should take from that, too, is she lied. She, under oath, said one thing one day, and under oath said another thing another day. And basically explained it because you guys are being mean, being the department, to the father of this child, and I didn't want to tell you I was married to him.
Counsel, you're opposing.
Right.
What is your response?
My response is contained in my brief, Your Honor, and I cite a case, and I can't bring it up at the top of my head, but it says a single instance of violating a court scheduling or discovery order is sufficient to grant a default and to conduct to be egregious. Right.
I wasn't sure that you had support for that.
The previous default, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yeah. This, if you read, it's document number 91. It is the transcript of day two of the trial, September 14th, 2010.
I don't mean you didn't have factual support. Oh. You have support for the proposition that the court can consider a tardiness in a previous case when considering whether it's persistent conduct.
Well, Your Honor, I'm certain there's not a case right on point. But if you can't consider somebody's consistent behavior, and it was the same kind of case. It was a TPR case. It was a case where her kids' rights, it's not like it was a ordinance violation or something. And we all conceded that. Attorney Murray was the guardian ad litem. I was the prosecutor, and Mabel's defense counsel at trial, Attorney Yolanda Lehner, was both her counsel in the Sam C. case and in both of these cases.
To be fair, comprehensive, you today put it in the context of notes.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think one of the things is, you know, sometimes we get caught up in words and law. But when people actually see something in action, when Mabel experienced the previous default on the SAMC case, that to me, you know, what is it when they teach? You retain 55% of what you hear, 75% of what you read, 85% of what you do. The optimal way to teach is to do it by example and how you do it. And how do we teach? We lecture to people, 55% retention, something like that.
No, a decision in this case, and we get a lot of DPR review requests. And, you know, a review request is going to be just a tip of the iceberg. Of all the cases. So there must be a lot of TPR cases through the court system.
Your Honor, and we're a block and a half away. If any of you justices want to come down and see a TPR case, I'd be more
anytime, right? Almost any day we can come in.
We're down there every day. I've got three of my colleagues and another person that works in our office. We'd be happy to share with you what really goes on because, like I said, when you start a case, I had no clue this is where we were going to end up on this case.
Okay. But the point is, you got a lot of TPR cases. The fact situations, exactly what happens and how many minutes they're late, it's all going to be a little different from case to case.
Absolutely.
And you don't even know what it's going to be at the end. As you say, cases evolve, right? And then when they get up to the Court of Appeals, they evolve. And when they get here, they don't look the same either. Now, in Evelyn, it was a jury trial to begin with. Evelyn was told to show up, and I may have, Tequila was told to show up, didn't show up, and the judge entered a default judgment.
Yes.
When it got up here, there was no argument that the default judgment should not have been entered as a sanction against not appearing. In other words, the parties agreed that the judge had the authority and could exercise the discretion and did so properly to enter a default judgment. That was not at issue. See paragraph 16. What was at issue is what has to be done if you're going to enter a default judgment. And the answer in Tequila, same answer as I read it, and Shirley E. was, if you're entering a default judgment, you, judge, have to take evidence. Right? Okay. And I suppose we would agree that a TPR can go on without the presence of the mother or father, assuming there was no order or assuming that they say, everybody says it's okay, right? In a criminal case, if the defendant doesn't want to show up, you can go ahead without him if you have to. You can put him in chains and he can be in an adjacent room, but yeah. It can go on. So that was the issue in Tequila, and the answer was you've got to give counsel. Now, in this case, unlike Tequila, Mabel Kay objects to the default judgment, saying that in itself was an abuse of discretion and should not have been entered on the basis of these facts, right? That's right. The difference with Evelyn. Now, I don't know enough about this to know whether the trial judge said, I shouldn't have entered the default without evidence, but I'm sticking with the default. Now I'll take the evidence. Is that what happened?
Your Honor, is it not clear? But let's accept the proposition that the default was entered and evidence was taken to support it. Let's accept it at that. It's very murky. I read it over 20 times. I can't tell you exactly, I sat through it.
That's what I thought. So what you got here now in our case is a mixture of, was this default judgment an erroneous exercise of discretion just generally under default judgment rules, mm-hmm. right? And that it should have been opened because it was 10 minutes or whatever.
Right.
That's one issue, which was not in Evelyn. And the second issue in this case, as I see it, is Evelyn and Shirley E. say counsel has a right to be there and has a right to put in evidence. And now you're cramping her style. I mean, So... seems to me that the court here is imposing two sanctions on Mabel Kay. One, it's a default, no jury, default in front of the court. That's one sanction, and that's Evelyn Kay, and it's assuming it's not erroneous, it's okay. And the second sanction for Evelyn not showing up is her lawyer's hands are tied. Now, fully, only one hand is tied. So you got two sanctions. So that seems a little stiff.
Your Honor, if that's the way you look at it, I would agree with you. But the thing is, you have to look at, too, is if you apply a harmless error or a prejudice standard to that, the question is, what evidence could she have presented?
Right.
And then the other thing is, like I said, I think if you review the transcript carefully, there was sufficient evidence the court had already heard on the 48415 sub 2 continuing knee grounds. All that evidence was already in. And that could be the saving grace here if the court looks at it and go, hey, you're right.
Well, then it erred in taking more evidence.
Well, Your Honor, again, that was me being safe. That was me saying I want to support the abandonment ground as well as the continuing knee ground. If that's a flaw, I'm here standing being accountable for it.
Justice Bradley.
Chief, if I may, just for clarification, the default here, could have been entered for non-appearance, as it was, I think, in Evelyn, or could have been entered as a sanction for a violation of a court order to appear, or arguably could have, as was referenced briefly in Evelyn, that sometimes can happen, and then Evelyn moved on after referencing him briefly. What does the record demonstrate that the circuit court did here in entering a default? Did the circuit court enter a default because of non-appearance, or did the circuit court enter a default for violation of a court order to physically appear?
I think it did the latter, Your Honor, because I think the case law is very clear that a person can't be defaulted for just failing to appear without an order for appearance when their counsel is present.
Well, that's maybe the case law, but I'm saying what does the record show here? I mean,
I don't think the record, again, is clear. I don't think the judge said, I'm entering the default. I move for default, and I don't remember. I think what I said is something to the effect of, Your Honor, I move for a default based upon her non-appearance. And we discussed, and there was established, there was a court order, May 24th, 2010, for personal appearance.
And if it is as a sanction for violation of a court order, as was referenced by Justice Wilcox and Evelyn, but just as I said, that case is all about non-appearance. What has to be shown in the record, and are those elements in the record shown here? That's a totally different avenue. You've got two different avenues. They intersect, of course, because you're dealing with the word appearance or non-appearance. But if someone doesn't show up and I'm a circuit court judge, I can default because they didn't show up. They didn't answer, okay? But that's very different than a procedure for sanction. They're very different. So what was employed here?
Your Honor, I think if you're talking about a sanction under 804.122A, it says, if a party fails to obey an order to permit or provide or permit discovery, the court in which the action is pending may make such orders in regard to the failures or just among the other following. And then there's a parallel provision, I think, when the court fails a scheduling pretrial order. And I think that's really what this is a scheduling or pretrial kind of order.
I am not arguing about what the law is. What I want to know is, what does the facts show in this case? Which avenue did the court employ?
Ms. Murray has helped me with this, Your Honor. This is page 62, again, on the trial transcript of September 14th, 2010, which I think is the document number 91. If you go to page 62, the court says, there have been, and then there's a couple dashes, the court did order that Ms. Kwan was to appear at all court appearances. That was issued on May 24th of 2010. Yesterday when we convened, right after we left, Ms. Kwan, as others, were informed that we were to reconvene a little bit before 9 o'clock. As indicated earlier, there was a contact by Ms. Kwan to Ms. Lehner shortly before 9 o'clock, indicating that she was under stress and wouldn't be coming. That indicated she was sick and indicated she was going to ride her bike here. She would have to be here within a half an hour. And I'm trying to see if the court referenced it as a sanction.
I read that. I read this stuff. And yeah. I didn't see any, I mean, there's no reference to the statute. There's no reference to a sanction at all.
And, Your Honor, again, I cannot remember off the top of my head when I moved for default. Why I asked it. I think I probably asked it as for a sanction for failure to follow the court order and appear personally.
So how do you want this written?
I'm sorry?
If you had to write this opinion, how would you write it?
Your Honor, I'm going to tell you what I think is the absolute best outcome, what is an achievable outcome and a reasonable outcome, and what is the outcome that I don't think is a good idea. I think one of the things the court should do here is this issue with regard to appeal or on partial relief. I think that's a bad idea. You already have 808.03 sub 2, which is permissive appeals, that can easily handle this. When the Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal, it could have gone back to the trial court and ended up coming back up through the trial court to getting the evidence from Ms. Kwan if grounds are established going to dispositional hearing. What I'd really like to see the court do is look at the Shirley E. case and say, okay, there's a bright line rule here when counsel is deprived completely, as in Shirley E., at either the dispositional or fact-finding hearing, that is a structural error. That is prejudice per se. But in all other cases, because TPRs are different, and we're involving kids, and the timelines are critically important for kids. These kids have been waiting for adoption for over 2 years. There are significant things that have happened in the lives of these kids. There are also significant things that have happened in the other lives, and you don't have that record before you, and I'm not going to bore you with that, but I could bore you for hours. What I think is important is the court look at each one of those cases where prejudice is alleged to do a prejudice analysis based upon the Strickland versus Washington test, which we're all very familiar with. You guys, they probably do it in your sleep.
So if there's only partial deprivation of counsel, prejudice.
But do a prejudice analysis. Look at what we had. Then I think you've got a guide under the Charles Jr. case, again, that I cited in my appendix to my brief, saying that, look, you got to look at whether it was prejudicial here, okay? Because, again, you're looking at these interests of these kids, too. That's an important reason to be a little different than the criminal law. We don't have other parties out there. We do have victims and we do have things, but they're not parts of these cases like these children are, right? and do the prejudice analysis and use that Charles Jr. case and say, look, because the mom didn't show up, she put her counsel in a bind. She put her counsel in a bind because, one, she wasn't there to testify as a witness, and the counsel didn't have any other witnesses available. So there was no prejudice. Return this to the trial court, let them finish it up, and if there's a problem with that, that Mabel Kay has an appeal from that. She doesn't lose any rights.
Do you want us to return to the trial court to have his, to make a record that supports the default?
I think my part of the record supporting the default is complete, to allow Mabel Kay.
But she said, I'm sorry, she said she was going to take more evidence.
Yes, right.
So that's what you want.
Right, and that's going to be to the court. Again, the court's heard that. And, Your Honor, I think there's one thing that we haven't had a chance to talk about. I want to talk about really briefly, if I just could.
Yeah, because your red light's been on for a long time.
I know. I think it's absolutely critical here, is you really have to think about whether the result of this case is reliable. And there's a lot of things in your case law about T-pairs that really talk about that. Unless I drop over dead tomorrow or become demented, I am never going to forget that this mom did not show up on the second day of trial. She did not show up in front of her first trial with regard to the kids saying C. And I have two transcripts that showed she lied under oath. Those are going to figure prominently if I have to retry this case to a jury. And as I sit here and stand here, I swear I won't forget those. Those will be part of my presentation. They'll be part of the evidence. And they'll be part of my closing argument. Your Honors, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Finley?
Not that I'm short. As this court knows, it's improper to cite to facts outside the record. And the facts with respect to the other child, Sam C., are not part of this record. And it's so for opposing counsel to testify, in effect, about that, I think is wholly improper. What's that? No, I'm talking about the opposing counsel right here, Mr. Rayfield. Is it proper for him to be talking about the Samuel C. case if it's not part of the record? And I don't believe it is.
There was another case that was part of the record that talked about her tardiness.
They talked about the tardiness, but my objection is, my understanding was that it was a voluntary termination, not a default finding. And he said it was a default finding. Okay. And in fact, that's fine. And in fact, if there had been a prior involuntary termination, why wasn't that fact raised under 948.41.5 sub 10, prior involuntary termination of another child within 3 years? So, but leaving that aside, I disagree totally that he, on the first day of trial, he established his record on the CHIPS claim, 48415 sub 2. I reread the trial from that day, the first day of the trial. I reread it last night. What you had was a Mr. Gasser, who was the probation officer of the father, and then you had Sandra Blank, who was a social worker in this case. But she left this case in August 2009, over a year before the hearing in this case. And furthermore,
was she involved in the case as long as the children were still with the mom, or was she off the case after that?
The children were, Isaiah was removed from the mother in 2007, and May was removed from the mother right after her birth, so
she was there, but the kids were always outside the home.
The kids were always outside of the home. That's correct. She testified, but didn't get to cross-examination. And when on the second day there was cross-examination of Ms. Blank, defense counsel asked her six questions. I counted them, six questions. What she testified at the remand hearing is that she believed her case would be put in through the second social worker, Ms. Brown, and that's who she tended to cross-examine. And so, and I think when you look at what the trial court ruled, when it was found that there were grounds, it ruled that there were grounds proven for abandonment. It didn't say anything for the CHIPS claim. So I dispute that entirely, that he is proving his ground for CHIPS. I don't think that's true. And I would say, just to be mean, make your clerks read that first day of the trial, and I think they'll agree with me.
Counselor, don't both of you agree, though, that it needs to go back for fact-finding, and aren't we arguing about whether you should start from the beginning with the jury or whether it goes back to fact-finding with the judge? So whatever was proved or not proved,
I agree that prejudice should not be the consideration here, but to the extent that it is, I would argue that it hasn't proven that.
But you don't approve it going back to the trial court for further fact-finding, do you? You want a new trial with a jury.
A new fact-finding hearing with a jury. That's correct.
Right. I understand that. But opposing counsel isn't objecting to more fact-finding.
No. He claims that he's already established his case under 48415 sub 2, the CHIPS claim, and that mother now has the opportunity to rebut it.
But when she goes back, she can call that social worker if it goes back, one would think.
In fact, I thought the way he put it in his brief was kind of funny. In chapter page 7 of his brief, he said that the case should be remanded, quote, to complete the fact finding to support the default. Kind of presupposes the conclusion. And I think that's the problem with sending it back before the trial court. The same trial court is because it does presuppose the same response. With respect to the whole constitutional statutory argument, the law is clear now. Why do you want to mess with that? I mean, how often does this come up? In this case, once the court realized that she had denied the right to counsel, which was her finding, she said, well, yes, there's got to be a remedy. It's clear. Why mess with that?
Clear counsel.
The law is clear that once you cannot deny the right to counsel in a TPR finding. Prior to the finding,
That's by statute, right?
That's by statute, right. But why does it matter? The law.
My understanding was that Mr. Rehfeld thought that you could argue that if you have a statutory a right to counsel, that what the counsel does and how the counsel acts might be different than if you have a constitutional right to counsel. So maybe if there were a constitutional right to counsel, you can't limit counsel to only cross-examination.
But
if you have a statutory right, maybe you can. That's the argument I heard. I don't know if we have to reach that.
You don't, and furthermore, there's no support for that anywhere in the law or anywhere in his brief. I mean, he's not cited any cases saying, well, you know, in this case, they found that that was a distinction that matters. I don't know. But my point is, why get into it? The law's clear. Why muddy it up?
You have a statutory right to counsel.
Right, and that you cannot deny that right. With respect to Justice...
Counsel,
yes,
you'll have to wind up pretty
okay,
quickly.
Well,
your red
with
light
that,
is
I
on.
Would just...
You summarize your argument, and then we'll do it. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Well, my argument is very simple. The court retains jurisdiction. It should have decided this case. None of the delay in this case was necessary. If the trial court, after... had simply applied the law and looked to see whether there was a reason that it was litigants are supposed to have their day in court and had allowed Mabel Kay to get back into the case, none of this would have happened. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Mr. Finley and Mr. Rehfeld for their arguments in yet another TPR case. The whole concept of the TPR is to move as quickly as one can, both at the trial court and in the appellate courts, so that children's lives are not held in limbo, but that we do have permanent placement as promptly as possible. I think that's quite evident under the state law, and it's very evident under federal law that's applicable to permanent placement. If the council don't know, the court has had a circuit court improvement program, which is a child improvement program, with federally funded for a number of years now, with the whole concept of both the welfare of the child and the protection of the constitutional rights of the parents. So the court system through that has attempted a number of programs for permanency, but we still get the cases. That concludes our hearing in 11AP 1825, 11AP 826, Dane County Department of Human Services versus Mabel K. The court is adjourned for scheduled September oral arguments, and the court will meet in the conference room at 3:25. We are adjourned.